This edition of Culture with Robert Bounds was first broadcast on the 6th of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Thank you, people on the internet, for your kind words about last week's show, which asked the question, what gets washed up? And saw producer Holly go mudlarking in Kent. We'll need no wellies for today's one, though. This week we're asking, what's the world's most popular museum? We've cheated, but only a bit, because the art newspaper, pals of the show so often, have just published their annual Much Mused Over attendance survey. Their man, Javier Pérez, will be here to crunch the numbers, and we'll also hear from one of the world's most imaginative artists about whether or not we should care at all about how many people see shows. Here is Jeremy Deller.
The more people that see museums, go to museums and see art, will support it in the future. You know, those young people become politicians and they'll understand the value of it. So, you know, you hope that it's a good thing for the country.
We've got our tickets, we're in the queue. It's all set up to answer the question, what's the world's most popular museum? Right here on Culture, with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Regular listeners should be used to our new Q&A format, but this week the art newspaper has almost already asked a question we want to investigate, and so we're going to delve into their answers. Last week the publication released the results of their exhibition and museum attendance survey for 2014. And what do those stats reveal? Well, they tell us that mixed media shows dominated in the US, that Van Gogh remains a box office hit, and most interestingly, that Taipei's National Palace Museum hosted the three most visited art exhibitions in the world last year. Fascinating stuff indeed. In a moment we're going to hear from Javier Pace, deputy editor at the art newspaper, who can walk us through the results. But before that, here's the top 10 most visited art museums for 2014.
Still at number 10, the Musée d'Orsay in Paris, holding firm with 3,500,000. A big climber, up 5 to 9, the National Museum of Korea in Seoul. At number 8, the other side of the Atlantic, Washington DC, the National Gallery of Art, beaten to 7th place by the National Palace Museum in Taipei, edging up towards 5.5 million visitors for the year. The Tate Modern in London is at number 6, just behind the Vatican Museums of the Vatican City, dropping 1 to 4. It's the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, but with 6.1 million, not a bad performance. It languishes, though. Far behind in 3rd place, the National Gallery in London. 6.4 million people, that's jumped up one place. But it's behind its city mate, the British Museum in London, at number 2 on 6.7 million. Still number 1. Far ahead of the rest of the pack. 9.26 million visitors in the year. It's Paris. It's the Louvre.
Javier, thanks for coming onto the programme. This is an exciting survey that the art newspaper has published. What makes surprising reading is that Asian museums are humongous and do exceptionally well. I think that I'm now going to struggle. People will hear me madly try and find the figures. But anyway, suffice to say that the National Museum of Taipei is top of the charts. I found this amazingly unusual.
It's got a very good collection. And, you know, for those who know the 20th century history of China, many of the objects in it were, in a way, sort of rescued, I suppose you'd say, and taken over at the Straits to Taipei. So they've got the huge drawing power of these remarkable artifacts and paintings that many...
This is stuff that would have not survived the Cultural Revolution.
Or you know, if they had survived, they would be in Beijing.
Yeah.
So really, when we asked them, well, what's your visitor breakdown? And, you know, half of their visitors come from the mainland. So what we're seeing is tourism from the mainland helping to boost those numbers, because it's Greater China's great collections, you know, half of it, or not half of it, some of it in Beijing, some of it in Taipei.
And that's the strange thing, that mainland Chinese coming to Taiwan to take a look at their own history. I mean, obviously those two countries, are they both countries? I mean, there's some pretty noticeable red flag politics going on kind of in that relationship as well. But that is a funny thing, isn't it? That there is no museum in mainland China that actually caters to the sort of visitor numbers that this museum in Taiwan can.
Well, there is. This is where we get tricksy.
Right.
Because funnily enough, this, it's even more so in because the Palace Museum in Beijing is part of the Forbidden City, huge tourist attraction. At the very end, we point out that we kind of, it's a bit like one of these awkward destinations where how do you separate the museum from the wider destination? And that 15 million visitors a year go to the Palace Museum in Beijing.
That so, counts like going to the Vatican is like going to a museum, isn't
that's
that
how we treat
thing?
It, yeah. So, the, okay. so the sort of blue ribbon goes still to the Louvre, you know, because we regard that, they're visiting, people are visiting the Louvre. So no, it's really, you're seeing, yes, it's China, it's Taiwan, but amazing cultural history there, pulling in the crowds both in Beijing and in Taipei.
And what can we discern from what people are going to see, what the most amount of people seem to want to see? Are people seeing new things or are people seeing old things? Do people want to go and see old masters or do they want to go and see Jeff Koons?
This year, I mean, it does vary. You know, 2 years ago, it was the Dutch Museum, the Mauritshuis, sending its wonderful old masters, Vermeers, etc. to Tokyo and around the world, getting huge crowds. This year, it is... when you set aside the old masters from China, we're talking a more contemporary artist sort of carrying the day. And that's why we've gone very large this year, because the world, as we say, went dotty over Yayoi Kusama, both in South America. And there's a she's got another retrospective, or there is another retrospective trundling around Korea, currently in Taiwan, heading to India.
And well, I wonder what we can learn from this. I mean, when I saw that Yayoi Kusama's work was so popular and been so much visited, I guess there's a lot of people maybe think that even if it's not easy to understand work, it is visually arresting. The things are big. They fill up these huge rooms with aplomb, right? There's something of that in it. We can get slightly curatorial and critical here.
Yes, it's spectacle. Yeah, it's spectacle.
We're not having to. And I wondered how important it is that we don't have to peer over someone's shoulder to see one of her works, like you don't for, you know, a Louise Bourgeois spider or something. These are sort of grand works that are easy for lots of people to see at once.
Yes. I don't know if you say it's easy because people were willing to camp outside the Museo Tamayo in Mexico City. I mean, you do, with all these sort of phenomena, you know, being part of it is part of the experience, you know.
Yeah.
That's where blockbusters really come into their own, the good, the bad, and the spectacular, yes.
Well, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? I suppose that's part and parcel of it, is that this is still very much, the success of lots of these shows is as much as you can be a well-branded museum, as much as you can get fantastic reviews, as much as you can be a big-name artist. Presumably it's word of mouth. It's people saying you've got to go and see that. And it is presumably, it's a bit like, it's in a way, it's a bit like going to a festival or experiencing live music. People don't mind queuing. There's some sort of fellow feeling among people, there's a bit of warmth in the queue, presumably.
Yes, it's being there. We looked a bit closer. Now, as you know, the Museum of Modern Art is, in many ways, can do no wrong and can do no right attendance-wise. It's being criticised for being too crowded and the types of shows it puts on, especially of late with the Bjork show going on at the moment. But when you really look at what's going on in that space, in those spaces in the museum, is actually that big atrium that in many ways, you know, it's not one of the architectural wonders of the museum world, but boy, when things go on there, it really does draw a crowd, and that can be Marina Abramović or Pippa Lutty-Rist. It's where their highest attendance figures come from. Yeah.
Where is the Middle East in all this? Because the art newspaper has run for years a lot of stories about Qatar buying a lot of stuff. Does anyone go and see it?
I think the Qataris are going to see it. Probably the most interesting, you know, who's going to visit question really is...
Yeah, and we have, for Abu Dhabi, and it's... You know,
well, it is Abu Dhabi, because those ones really are being built to attract an international tourist as well as locals. I mean, the Louvre, to their credit, has been, you know, they've kind of revealed their plans for the galleries. They're obviously going to be organising temporary exhibitions. The Guggenheim is now being able to reveal some of its plans. But the question for those is, you know, it's really who's going to get off the plane and spend 48 hours and where they're going to come from. It'll be Europe, but may well be Russia. It may be India. It'll be people on long hauls. That's the one to really watch. No one is saying what the estimated visitor figures are. I mean, who knows? But then, you know, 10 years time, they will be, I'm sure, in that list.
Yeah. This is a nice part of the survey as well, that you've interviewed curators and museum directors, Massimilio Gioni from the New Museum in New York, Ralph Rogoff at the Hayward here in London. Do they care? I mean, they've written eloquently and quite wittily about how to put on shows, how not to put on shows in certain cases as well. Do they care about footfall? I mean, they have to to a certain extent, but is it a primary concern, did you feel, by putting this survey together? Or did you feel that actually they're very interested to know what people think of the shows more than how many people come to them?
They definitely, I would get a sense, and you can imagine putting yourself in their shoes, and some of them are now directors. Mm. They are directors. You know, Ralph Rogoff at the Hayward, Thelma Golden at the Studio Museum in Harlem, Ivona at the Whitechapel. Yes, of course they care. And that's why it was great having Charles Samurai Smith, of the chief executive of the Royal Academy of Art, writing very eloquently about how the Royal Academy cares about the number of visitors it goes. And also, but what came across is how you get this kind of, a really big popular show with a huge footfall helps subsidize, to use a crude term, the smaller, more specialist shows. Yeah. It's about striking a balance. With some of the shows they're talking about, people are still talking about them. So, you know, just how many people went through the doors between the 3 or 5 months the show was on is just one very specific measure, as we know, you know, how the catalogue spread, memories of the show, how it was talked about. Those things matter a lot as well.
Charles Samurai Smith's piece was really nice. Millions of people have always wanted to see big shows, and almost the bigger the show, the more people want to see it. People want to be, as we said before, people want to be part of that bigness themselves and experience the grandeur, the size, what everyone's talking about. But critics often say, oh, well, you know, it can't be that good because so many people have been to see it. Is that something you, at the art newspaper, you're sort of in the middle of that? You're reporting probably from both sides, presumably. On which side do you think you fall? I mean, do you feel that certainly publicly funded or publicly aided institutions probably have a bit more of a responsibility to get as many people through their doors as they can?
I mean, there's I know we're not conflicted about it, but it was quite funny to read someone, a museum director in the States, sort of tongue-in-cheek calling us this our statistical pawn. This whole survey as we kind of
I think, you know, there's raunchier things on the market than the new edition of the art newspaper, if you will forgive me.
But what you don't get there is the sort of the quality of the experience, and no one wants to be, and that's why museums do kind of, you know, limit the amount of people through the door through ticketing. You can't get to that nuance, you know, not that, you know, it's whether the cost of the ticket or how many they release. As I say, some people love being part of a crowd, others, you know, run a mile and will do anything to avoid it, maybe go in very early or miss the show. So how do we feel about it? I just think what we kind of like to do is, it's the one chance you can really start comparing and get surprises. And you can see, you know, where the cities that just, you know, excel in these kinds of shows. And that's why I always sort of name check Paris, because, you know, when you look at the traditional art centres of the world, New York, London, Paris still, you must say, it always seems to sort of surprise and delight with just the range of these shows that they put on, whether they're really interesting thematic shows, a new take on Van Gogh. It still seems to be, you know, the Parisians have a love affair with these big shows, and their curators excel. And it's interesting how they're exporting those, whether it's to Korea or to Tokyo, or in the past to South America. And we see that, you know, in Malaga, a kind of variation of that. So I think
it overshadows London. Yeah, so if there's a battle of brains and brawn, maybe it comes down in that arm wrestle to it's Taiwan versus France. Who would have thought it? Javier Pez from the Art Newspaper, thank you so much for your time. Well, we've heard from the person crunching the numbers, but what about the people who make up those figures? The V&A here in London attracts over 3 million visitors each year, and Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan hops on the bus to speak to a few of them, queuing up on a grey day for the current hit retrospective of Alexander McQueen's designs.
Mark Happel. I'm in town from New York. I had seen the show at the Metropolitan and heard it was a bigger, more expanded show, so I thought I would see it here.
How frequently do you visit art museums?
Quite frequently.
Do you find that you go to exhibitions that you maybe don't know so much about because you trust the institution which is putting it on?
Yes, yes.
Well, we're both in the fashion trade. And my husband now drives with Addison Lee, and he took Lee McQueen on several occasions and spoke about the industry.
How frequently do you visit art museums?
Not very often, not as often as we should.
Do you find yourself returning to the same institutions often?
Yes, I do, because of the usually the fashion ones are here.
If you go in to see a particular exhibition, do you find that you just see that and then leave, or do you wander around and see other things?
Wander around.
I think we'd pick something that would interest us in the first place. If we happen to discover something else on the way, then yes, or afterwards, then yes. But we'd probably go to something because it is targeted specifically at something that we would want to see.
Thanks, Henry. That was Henry Rees-Sheridan reporting from the V&A.
Whether you want to know the latest in the world of luxury retail...
It's a wonderful experiment. I love that idea, and I can see people really going for it.
Or analysis of the main movers in the aviation sector...
It's a great brand. It's a great service in many ways.
Tune in every weekday at noon London time for The Briefing. From our studios at Midori House in London, we bring you up to date with all the latest news, as well as insight and analysis from our unrivaled team of industry experts.
I do think that companies get to a certain size when they get too big for comfort.
We also take a look at what's making headlines across the Atlantic.
All the papers are pretty much covering it in different ways. The New York Times, we'll look at that first. They have a few stories about it. They have the straight news story, and then they have a more human interest story.
A pacey roundup of the day's key stories and fresh reports from our correspondents and bureau all around the world. Every weekday at noon London time, tune in to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Now, what does an artist think in response to visitor numbers? Sure, an attendance bar graph with an ascending arc sure seems satisfying to any artist who sweated and worried over a show. But is it actually important? Jeremy Deller has won the Turner Prize. He's represented Great Britain at the Venice Biennale, and he is very much an artist involved with people, with mass movements, with shared histories and experiences. Indeed, he came into our studio to talk about a current initiative to get Brits to vote in the upcoming UK general election, and so we asked him about popularity.
For them, it's important to get a lot of people. Visitor numbers are very important. I don't know if it's actually tied to their funding, but it's very closely observed and looked at when funding rounds happen, when they know how, if they think that their visitor numbers have gone up, then that's a good thing. And the participation in British museums is very different from it is if you go to France or most places in the world, where museums are usually...
But there's less of a pressure on that.
Yeah, they're usually quite quiet.
Yeah.
But you go to museums in Britain, on the whole, in London, they're busy all the time, which is actually a great thing.
It's a lovely thing to see, but it's sometimes a bit frustrating when you're trying to check one particular thing.
Depends
out.
On the show.
Yeah.
It's great at the British Museum because there are big objects that people are around and kids are running around, but if it's a little quiet painting show, you don't really want that necessarily, those numbers. So it's in context, it's a great thing.
But maybe the general gist, I mean, this is, and of your work and of the thing, is that actually the more people that see this stuff, the better. And if you have to wait your turn to see them, that might be just part of the success of a particular building a particular program.
Yes, and also the more people that see museums, go to museums and see art, will support it in the future, and will become, you know, those young people become politicians and they'll understand the value of it. So, you know, you hope. It's a good thing for the country, and not an exclusive thing like it can, you know, in America. It's quite an exclusive pursuit still, museum going,
because ticket prices expensive. Yeah. It's not free.
So it's in Britain, it's different.
Do you think that there's maybe too much emphasis? I mean, do you ever feel there's too much emphasis put on, you know, the marquee shows? What's got getting the footfall this year? Is that a pressure that you ever feel, or are you not really interested in?
Not for me. No, it isn't. I'm in a position where I don't have to worry about those things. If I was beginning a career and struggling in a career, maybe, then it could get to you. But luckily, I'm not in that position. But the whole structure of the art world and the market can be quite stressful when you think about it or take part in it. And I'm sure for young artists,
it's sort of exciting, but it's absolutely terrifying at the same time.
Was that the same, or do you think that's changed? Are we on a bit of a shift in, I don't know, generational shift in that?
It's sort of become
thing?
More like everything, like the property market. It's just become bigger and more money coming into it and more money sloshing around. So it's become a bigger thing because there's more rich people in the world and they're spending their money on art. So it's changed the nature of it, which is good. It is good. It has to be good, really, in a way. But it has its pitfalls. Just have to be aware of it and know, be confident about where you stand within it. That would be my advice. Just be aware of it and know about it.
So I always wonder whether you say there's more rich people, they spend their money on art at the moment. Do you think that filters down? I mean, when we think of a certain generation of artists who all maybe railed against the system, but a system that still at that stage funded them to do things. Mm. And I think that seems to be sorely missing. And I wonder whether we'll have another generation or whether they'll have to think about market forces. They'll have to think about selling their degree show before they can think about having a career almost. Do you have a point of view on that?
I think maybe the trend might be for artists to move out of London.
Yeah.
So there'll be other art scenes, which is probably a really good thing.
Yeah.
In opposition to London, or just very different from the London art scene, where you don't have to make a lot of money to survive. That might happen. But there'll always be a very broad, the art world is a very broad church. You just hear about a certain aspect of it because it's the glamorous.
We hear about the top 1%, I guess.
Yeah, exactly, like anything.
Yeah.
So there's tons of other things going on underneath it. People doing all sorts of things.
That was artist Jeremy Deller making sense about the bums on seats school of quantifying a successful show. To finish the show, we're now going to turn to art writer and Monocle's Berlin correspondent, Kimberly Bradley. She tells us what contemporary art museums are doing or need to do to draw in new audiences. Kim begins by giving culture producer Holly Fisher her take on the use of celebrity names to tempt new crowds.
I think any museum, especially for contemporary art right now, has to rely a little bit on big names just to grow a new audience. The Bjork Show has been criticized because it's a name that is very famous, but maybe not necessarily in the art world, and it's been criticized for not doing her retrospective very well. It's apparently in this very small space in the atrium in a kind of a black box. Strange artifacts and portions of it look just like music videos. It's a lot of the content that's being criticized. The blingy hype around it was also quite criticized, but in another, like seen from another point of view, I think it makes sense to expand the notion of what a museum does in order to keep up with the times. You do have to grow an audience. You may have a show like Bjork or like Marina Abramovic's The Artist is Present to draw in a much younger crowd that may stay for the rest of the afternoon and take a look at monographic special exhibitions on somebody like Picasso, or take a look at the MoMA's permanent collection or any museum's permanent collection. So it is a bit of a strategy to get people in for the bling and then get them to stay for the art.
What about the institutions that don't show so much contemporary things and maybe don't want to rely on, current celebrities? What are they doing to bring in new audiences?
I think what they're doing is packaging some of the familiar names in new and interesting ways. I've seen some exhibitions here in Berlin, for example. The Berlinische Galerie did a really quite amazing show on Berlin and Vienna and their relationship, but all of the art was from about 100 years ago. So it was greatest hits, Otto Dix, who's very famous, George Grosz, who's very famous. But it was a show that really, really looked at the narratives between these two cities. And it was quite sexy. The way they did it, the way they hung it was sexy. So it was older work, but shown in a new way. And I think museums throughout the world are kind of relying on this a little bit more.
What about additional programming that museums are doing? People are showcasing bands, there's screenings, there's lots of talk sessions. Do people have shorter attention spans now? Do they need to have slightly more interactive exhibitions to keep them coming in?
I think there is definitely an element of this, especially, I don't want to sound ageist in any way, but the younger generation is used to a really fast stream of information coming in and out. And I think part of this new programming has to do with this. I mean, we've seen Kraftwerk playing concerts at the New National Gallery in Berlin, as well as at the MoMA a few years back. I think, however, there's possibly a counter argument that along with the concerts and film screenings, I'm seeing a lot more symposia that are very theory-based. You might see at some of the museums here in Berlin or throughout Europe, a 3-day symposium taking a look at the role of technology in art, and those things are packed. So that may argue a little bit against the short attention span thing. I think people are just hungry to talk about what they're seeing. So some audiences might really want to see something quite easily digestible and very interesting quickly. But again, they might stay and kind of want to talk about it afterward. Or you might have two separate audiences for both. I think in essence, museums are trying to touch the various strata of society, bring them in, have them participate a little more for various reasons, because there are a lot of different people who go to museums for different reasons.
But do you think that this is going to see a bit of a shift in how gallery spaces are used? And, you know, it's going to be a bit more of a sort of cross-platform rather than just art galleries?
I think so, and I think it's kind of already happening. Here in Berlin about 2 years ago, it was actually part of the biennial, but it was in one of the main institutions. We had Occupy living for 2 months on the first floor of Kunstwerk, a contemporary art center. And at the same time, they were running a series of symposia. It doesn't really get much more cross-platform than that, and that was kind of controversial because it was a very political move on the curator's part. But on a more conventional level, yes. And there are a lot of discussions right now as to what the role of the museum is. 200 years ago when they were founded, the Louvre is arguably the first type of museum of its kind. It was when the royal collections were finally put on for public view. You know, how has this evolved since then? Who is art for? You know, these are really, really big questions. But I think a lot of people agree that art is for everybody, and different ways of experiencing art will touch different people. And I do enjoy this kind of cross-platform populist take on what a museum's role could be. You know, it's less of an archive of history or the legacy of one royal who collected certain kinds of work than a place for people to meditate on all the different things that affect our society.
That was Monocle's Berlin correspondent Kimberly Bradley bringing us to the end of this week's show. The Art Newspaper's exhibition and museum attendance survey results are out now, and you can find out how to get your hands on them at theartnewspaper.com or, I dare say, at your local newsstand. So, Jerry Springer fans, what have we learnt by asking what's the most popular museum in the world? That the answer goes further and deeper than just attendance, that museums are places that should please a lot of the people a lot of the time, but shouldn't lose their learning and intellectual muscle, their canny curators, or sense of the absurd either. Like throwing balls in the air and catching them time after time after time, getting it right is a juggling act. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was the indomitable non-welly wearing this week, Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time next week. For the time being, I've been Robert Bounds. Thank you very much for tuning in.